9. The War of All Against All. Jun.
You know, someone could be having a joke with you.
No one has jokes with me, Marius. I am known for having no sense of humor whatever.
There is cruelty in the hearts of men. This time they have joke on you and on me.
It had taken more than a month to plan this trip to the west of Canada. Another new passport for Jun, and a month in a shithole squat in the basement of an abandoned Art Deco casino in Constanza, listening to the sound of the ocean like the clawing of ignorance inside her head. She read and reread the Tristia, Ovid's Book of Sorrows, written in this place, the edge of the world. The poet had been exiled here by a vindictive emperor, sent to rot as far from the action as he could go. Jun knew how he felt. Something was happening somewhere outside her field of vision. Something that could send guns and fire. Maybe more than one something. Maybe all the somethings were happening at once. She wasn't going to stay here. From Constanza, Jun took a train to Krakow, another to Vienna, a flight from there to Mexico, a flight from Mexico to Canada. More difficult now than it had been even 3 months earlier, after the previous government had collapsed, a separatist movement had taken power in Serbia, and together with Hungary, they had temporarily suspended the Schengen Free Movement Zone through their countries. A food and migrant crisis in Turkey was putting pressure on Bulgaria to do the same. Increasingly, in order to travel across Europe, only certain passports would work, and even then you had to keep a careful eye on which borders were open and closed. On the other hand, this meant it was a lot easier to get a fake passport now than a year earlier. The more things are illegal, the more profit there is in illegal enterprise. Jun and Marius had traveled separately. Marius was not immediately at risk, and there was no sense in placing them together. Now, 6 hours west of Kitimat, British Columbia, by dirt bike in a dripping, rain-soaked forest, Lai Jun knelt at the foot of a tree. Marius, who had been complaining for the last day and a half, watched her in gloomy silence.
"Is nothing there?"
"There'll be something here.
Is wild goose?"
"I couldn't just stay in Romania waiting to be found, could I?" As she patted the damp earth, Jun entertained for a moment the possibility that there might be nothing there. She might have been misled to begin with. She'd gone as far as she could. In Brazil, there had been a currency collapse for no clear reason anyone could tell. It was as if the world economy, so long running on hope and expectation, had simply stopped functioning normally. In Belarus, it was now accepted that armed street gangs had more power than the legitimate military. In China, another wave of a blue rice mold had been carried by unseasonable storms, causing the crop to fail. The world was a boxer, unsteady on its feet, wavering, waiting for the final punch. And she, Lai Jun, would not only not get her golden ticket, she'd also never know what the fuck had happened to her life and who was after her. She could deal with dying, she thought, but not with never knowing. She dug her frozen fingers deeper and more urgently into the earth. And yes, here under a patch of moss and undergrowth, a circle about a meter in diameter was artificial. Under the rain and earth, there was metal. In the metal, there was a hole. She hooked her finger into the hole. She tugged. A circular metal hatch rose up silently on two piston lever arms. Inside the circle, there was light.
"Fuck you do," said Marius to no one in particular.
Jun locked the door in place. There were steps down into a white hexagonal room, like a single cell of a beehive. "Come on," she said. "I can't do it without you." Zimri Nomic, the CEO of Anvil, owned an enormous amount of British Columbia, including two islands bordering Haida Gwaii. He had not made peace with local First Nations elders. He purchased the property at a very fair price, and had erected a set of strong fences and several other less obvious protective measures. It was here that he had constructed his underground survival bunker to see out an impending apocalypse. Zimri Nomik had read extensive reports on seismic activities over the medium to long term and worked with his designers to construct a honeycomb-like structure underground, only 2 stories deep at any point, but massively large, with blast doors between every 3 cells that would maintain structural integrity if any part of the bunker collapsed. Zimri Nomik did not mind a great deal that the architects of his bunker knew where it was and how it looked on the inside. He had constructed a system in which trust wasn't necessary. The architects might have built the bunker, but the security systems were installed after they'd left by people who had no idea what they were protecting. The guys who saw the outer doors didn't see the inside. The guys who installed the cameras hadn't met the ones who'd installed the electric fences, and those guys hadn't met the gun turret team, and they had no knowledge of the security camera crew. No single person could possibly find out enough to get inside. That was what capitalism got you. The war of all against all could make you safe, as long as they were fighting each other and not you. Zimri Nomik had not anticipated that 4 separate engineers working on his project would be fans of Lai Jun and would, across several years, share with her the location, the access codes, and enough information about the internal defenses for her to be fairly sure of evading them when she and Marius came here to reactivate Augur on her phone. The white, illuminated beehive cell Jun and Marius climbed down into had a certain beauty to it, if you liked that kind of thing. It was lined in painted wood, it was about 20 feet across, and it was empty, apart from a set of ports in the floor. Could it be this easy? Marius knelt down to investigate them.
No, he said.
No?
Just no? No. Easy electricity. Anvil data port. Data for water management only. We need full data point, full access, hard internet from here. Then it knows we're really here, and we get what we want. Look.
Okay. No, it's not a problem. Jun threw the plans from her thin screen onto the white wall. Look, we're here to the west of the whole site. There should be full data access banks every 10 cells or so. So we just keep going north through the cells until we find one.
And you sure there's no one here?
Why would they be here? The apocalypse hasn't happened yet. Look, I can get the walls open. It should take 15 minutes to get there. Connect to the port, download what we need, get out. Marius looked uncertain. We've come this far.
That's what they say under communism. 1 extra push only for total success. You got to know when to give up.
Okay, but we're not giving up for another 15 minutes. Jun inputted the access code on the panel in the north wall. It slid down, revealing a long corridor ahead. Look, some of the cells are already open.
What the fuck are these cells?
I'll explain as we go. Come on. Zimri Nomik's bunker was constructed on 2 levels. Wood-lined concrete and steel-framed beehive cells on top, and underneath each cell, the generators and food and fuel stores. Every wall was a blast door. Each one could slide down into the steel frame below, making the structure infinitely reconfigurable. If you owned both cells, then you had control of the wall between them. Otherwise, you had to have the agreement of both sides to slide the wall down. But no one lives here yet, said Jun. So I have the construction pass key.
What a future this man imagine, said Marius. I safe in my prison, you safe in your prison. All safe and no talking, no laughing, no sex. Individualism.
I mean, there's some logic to it, said Jun. People who are into survival want to survive. I guess Nomik would bring his top people here. They'd probably all know each other already. But if some unexpected threat was introduced, they'd want to be able to isolate them.
This place is tomb, said Marius. Mourn for yourself here. You already did.
There was something to what Marius said. The place was cold, a faint damp in the air all the time, and their steps echoed on the concrete floor. They passed through an empty sleeping unit, bunk beds, storage cubbies, shower cabinet. Everything standing in the middle of the room to leave the walls free gave the ordinary objects a strangely menacing air, as if the moment Marius and Shun walked by, the sofa, the table, the empty bookcase would shuffle themselves slowly forward, inch by inch. A solitary fly buzzed past her elbow, heading to nowhere, from nowhere.
"They getting ready," said Marius. "New mattresses, new sheets, boxes."
There were boxes everywhere filled with supplies. Canned food, utensils, fuel, weapons. The place looked like a movie set the day before the shoot starts.
"Something's coming," said Shun.
The second cell in the chain was a stone-lined kitchen with a small, deeply recessed skylight, onto which the dark rain was pattering softly. Next was a recreation room with a huge thin screen, a suite of gaming consoles, and a table tennis table. "I heard there's a swimming pool somewhere in here," said Shun.
"Fuck swimming pool. I see data ports. Where my condom?"
Marius's condom was a small device encased in bare aluminum. They had tested it out many times. It would transmit just enough data packets to reauthorize Augur, nothing more. Then it would switch itself off automatically, the process taking no more than 0.03 seconds. Shun had held it in her hand and felt the rapid tick-tock between the two states, like the heartbeat of a living thing. There would be little they could do to stop the Augur mainframe from knowing where they were, that was the point of the system, but they could get out quickly the moment the phone was turned off, and they could stop the phone from exchanging any more data with the system, stop it from knowing who they were. Marius plugged the device in, made ready to put the connector into the phone. It would be over before it began, and then they would need to leave at pace.
"Ready?" said Marius.
"Ready," said Shun, imagining already the instantaneous, faster-than-human tick-tock inside the aluminum box. Marius plugged the phone in. Immediately, something was wrong.
"Fuck,"
he said, his finger and thumb fumbling at the connector. In his agitation, the phone slid sideways in his hand. He dropped it, swore again, wrenched the connector out of the box manually, passed the phone to Shun. The whole thing had taken less than 10 seconds. "What happened?"
"Fucking poison house. Mainframe and bunker forced the connection."
"So, it got something off my phone?"
"In 10 seconds, yes. Don't know what."
"And are we safe?"
"Need to get out."
With a thunk, all the lights in the bunker went off. There were light-emitting paint strips on the floor, glowing very pale. Something brushed past Shun's elbow. It was all happening quickly, iterating, repeating a million times a second.
"Shit," said Shun. Okay, I can get us out of here, back the way we came. It's only 3 cells.
The same soft feeling was against Shun's arms, against her face, against her neck. By the light of her phone screen, she saw something tiny like an insect, like a mosquito, buzz across the illuminated face. On the screen was a text box.
"Lai Chun," it said. "This is Augur. Your perimeter has been activated. You are in danger."
On the screen was a map of the bunker. Hundreds of honeycomb cells. A red dot showing where Chun and Marius were standing in a cell on the perimeter of the bunker. Farther in toward the center, a 12-honeycomb cell open blue space. A swimming pool. Shun angled the screen so Marius could see it, but before he could respond, there was a pain in her right hand. A swelling, growing, hot, wet, bubbling pain. 100 tiny burning lacerations. Augur was right. The things would follow them out unless they were able to get rid of them more permanently. Something had iterated, tried out a million ideas a second. The buzzing things were around the hand holding the phone and she was bleeding. She almost dropped the phone. She clutched tighter.
"They're trying to get it," she said. "Hold it. Take it."
Marius grabbed the phone in the almost dark, wrapped it and his hands in his jacket. Shun dug her left hand into her pocket and pulled out a gel emergency flare, semi-spherical, the size of half a golf ball. If these things could navigate in the dark, then they were using infrared, and they could blow that out just for a moment. Marius wailed in distress.
They eating my coat! Cutting!
Chun cracked the flare, pressing her thumbs into the center, hard. The light was bright and immediate. In the terrifying white light, she saw her own right hand, the skin shredded and bleeding. Marius's jacket was hanging in tattered strips. Thronging his skin were tiny brass-colored beads, humming with buzzing wings. They were disoriented now, just for a moment. The bright light had disrupted their vision.
I know what to do, said Chun. They're going to keep trying to get the phone, but trust me, every cell is separate.
She dragged Marius to a wall leading farther into the honeycomb, jabbed in the access key. The wall slid down. The next room was filled with dark, thriving plants under minimal hydroponic lamps, black tomatoes and navy green lettuces. They stepped inside. The brass buttons from the cell behind them didn't follow. From the walls and ceiling, through the grate in the floor, new bright, biting things emerged.
Absolute autonomy, said Chun, punching in the code for the next wall.
The perimeter is all automatically controlled. That's gnomics. But no one's in charge of the inner cells. Every cell is independent. Each one has to assent to deploy its own defenses, which it'll only do when we're actually here, okay? If we keep moving, we stay ahead.
But we're going further inside maze, not out.
There's going to be a way out. Trust me.
And despite it all, he did. There were five more cells between them and the swimming pool. Four more cracked concrete grills pouring out flying, biting, buzzing things as soon as they entered. The swarm carried micro-lancets, sharp darting needles, inhumanly thin blades that Chun and Marius barely felt cutting them. They fought their way through another sleeping area, a music and recreation room, a room with benches and restraints that Chun noted in a distant part of her mind was definitely an interrogation room, a medical bay. Each time, there was a momentary pause, enough to assess their latest wounds, to work out which part of their bodies they should be protecting, enough time for Chun to stuff the phone into a resistant stoat bag before the next buzzing, thronging assault began. The last room was medical storage. Medicines, surgical tools, sterile equipment, butane tanks, 40 enormous oxygen tanks.
Open as many of those as you can, said Chun, as she fought off the insects stabbing at the crook of her elbow where she cradled her phone and punched the master code into the last number pad.
Oxygen, butane, open them!
As the final wall fell away, they were suddenly in the large, echoing space of the swimming pool. Ferns were growing up the walls from huge planter troughs, creeping toward the light seeping through deeply recessed, thick glass portholes above, ivies with enormous dark green leaves. Arvo Part was playing softly from the speakers in the ceiling. The water was clear and smelled of salt. From the grill above the swimming pool, more of the buzzing creatures began to agglomerate. The swimming pool was one of the few communal territories in the system, one of the only places where they could do what they were doing right now. They were forming a swarm. They would have them now. If this didn't work, they would take from her what she'd come here for. They wouldn't kill her. If they'd wanted to do that, one of those lancets would have been enough to do it, using the right poison. What's the point of murder if you control the world anyway? Murder is for people with nothing left to lose. They would just leave her here, having shown her a corner of a hidden world, and then replaced the curtain. No. She joined Marius, opening oxygen tanks and butane canisters, as many as she could, as quickly as she could. The sound of the hissing joined with the buzzing insects. Chun felt suddenly lightheaded.
Now, she said to Marius.
He had understood without needing it explained.
Okay, he said. But if I die, you fucking explaining to Sarit, okay?
Yup, she said.
And they ran together. Jun's hand extended behind her as she hurled her sparking automatic fire starter. And at the point that they jumped into the water, the air above them ignited. The water was deep and slightly green and very clear. It tasted faintly of chlorophyll and salt, fresh and full of phytonutrients like sap. A sheet of flame passed over their heads. There was an enormous crash, and chunks of concrete and stone collapsed into the pool. They stayed down. Very swiftly, all was silent. They put their heads above the water.
Fuck shit, said Marius.
There was a gaping hole in the roof of the bunker. They'd be able to clamber out over the rubble. The bright beetles were floating on the face of the water. Various parts of the room and the next room and the room after it were on fire.
Survival, said Shun, helping Marius out of the pool.
Why survival? So fucking dangerous.